let me just remind you of what was the classical conclusion about the motion of a string in space, space-time. So the statement was that minimal area surfaces in space-time can be described by solving some linear equations. You know, just Laplacian of x nu equal to zero, together with some constraints, which is the vanishing of the classical stress tensor. These are constraints because if you take a derivative of this, like if I take the bar of this, it vanishes because of the equations of motion. So you can think about this as something I need to impose on my boundary conditions, and it will remain true for the evolution of the string. But anyway, I invite you to check this, you know, write down some classical string solutions. You know, there are some soap bubbles in actual Euclidean three-dimensional space as solutions to these equations. It's a fun exercise. Let me just give you the silliest example. I just have a soap bubble wrapping a plane. Okay? So what I do, I set x1 equal to u1, x2 equal to u2. Is this a solution? Yes, and I write this in complex coordinates. This looks like z plus z bar over 2. This looks like z minus z bar over 2i. So when I do del x1 is 1 over 2. Del x2 is I over 2. Sorry, 1 over 2i. And the square of this plus the square of this vanishes. Okay. So you can definitely write actual minimal surfaces solving these equations. So you should try to find solutions in R3 to the far 2. Now, in order to do something quantum mechanically, we need to figure out how to impose these constraints properly. And the proper way to do it is to use ghosts. And we'll start discussing ghosts in the second half of this lecture. But it's, I mean, you can get most of the answers you want just borrowing a couple pieces of information from a proper derivation of the answer. I'm going to just describe for you now a quantization by hand. It is analogous to Gupta-Bleuler quantization in electromagnetism. So you want to impose a classical constraint. You sort of want, intuitively, you want it to hold when sandwiched between physical states. And one way you can try to make it happen is that the positive modes of T annihilate the physical states from the left. And that negative modes of T annihilate the physical modes on the, from the right. So you can try to impose equations like Ln acting on physical modes equal to zero for positive N. And dually, Ln acting on physical modes in the future is to zero if N is smaller than zero. For the zero modes, you have a little bit more latitude. Let's say I had them kill the these physical modes. I included an unknown Casimir energy here. So we saw that a single boson gave minus 1 over 24 Casimir energy. But the contribution of the ghosts has to be computed carefully, and we'll do it later. For now, let me just tell you that the final answer is that if the dimension of space-time is 26, here you put 1. Furthermore, states which are physical but are also... so let me define a null state It's a state which is in the image of ln. A state which is physical and null will have zero in the product with physical states. So you want to throw it away in order to have a well-defined inner product on your Hilbert space. So the statement is the space of string states. When you study it by hand this way, is the space of physical states divided or quotiented by the space of null states. Okay, so this, you have seen something like that in electromagnetism, I'm sure. So let's try to use this definition and apply it to the sort of space of states of 26 free bosons on the watch, on the cylindrical worksheet. So I wrote down the Fock space yesterday. Let me write it again. I have a bunch of ground states for the Fock oscillators, which are eigenstates of translations in space-time. Here now I'm going to put a space-time index on my little p. And then I add descendants. Let me just say it immediately because I always forget to say it. I write the constraint for T. I also have the constraint for T bar, of course. Okay. And null states are these, or things that are in image of ln or ln bar, either. Okay? Sorry. Whenever I say something about the unbarred oscillators, there is the same statement to be made for barred oscillators. I try to always remember to write it down, but sometimes I forget. Any questions?
Mm-hmm. What are the new indices on the oscillator operators?
Oh, sorry, you're right. So we are quantizing scalar fields like this, right? So now when you expand them out, you're gonna have the sort of thing that I was writing yesterday. I don't remember all the truants and i's. But now the oscillators carry the same Lorentz index as x. This suggests immediately the possibility of some troubles, because now the commutators will have to have, because of Lorentz invariance, the Lorentz metric here. So I risk, if I work in a Lorentz invariant way, I risk getting some negative norm states. Because, for example, if I try to compute something like this, when I do the commutator, the norm, I will get a norm that looks like this, like this. So you can see that the zero component of the oscillators risk creating state with negative norm. You should be very worrisome. Happily, it turns out that once you restrict yourself to physical states and quotient by null states, all this, the inner product becomes positive definite. This is a very non-trivial statement. It's a hard theorem. It's analogous to what you saw in QED. Right? In QED, the Fox pay, you know, the Fox pay is created by the modes of the gauge connection, had some null states, right? But then the quotient of physical states by null states gave a positive definite in the product.
I'm not sure I see how a null state could be physical since its overlap with any physical state is zero.
Indeed, that's why I'm quotienting them away.
It's a quotient in a way that has to
be. Are you unhappy about the name physical?
I'm not sure. It would be said there can be null states.
I can change this name. I can call them constrained or, I don't know, pick a name. I'm happy with whatever name. Whatever it is, the string states are this quotient.
Okay.
Right. I mean, it's perfectly possible for a state to be annihilated by L and be in the image of L. We will definitely discuss such states momentarily. The same way as it happens in electromagnetism, right? You start with four polarization for your gauge field. The physical condition kills one polarization, and then you quotient away another polarization to be left with two actual polarizations, right? So the longitude, there is a, remember, there is some right, in QED, right, you have some polarization vector, right? The physical condition, the constraint imposes the polarization is perpendicular to the momentum, right? And then you quotient by polarizations which are parallel to the momentum. So let me read that. So a physical, the analogous of this, of the states here, are polarizations which are annihilated by the momentum, and the analogous of null polarizations are polarizations which are proportional to the momentum. And because p squared is zero, it's perfectly possible for something to be both physical and null. So, for example, if the momentum was 1, 1, 0, 0, right? The physical, so the constraint eliminate only leaves things that look like A, B, C, right? And then the null. Are things of the form AA00. And so you're left with 2 degrees of freedom. Any questions? I will say something completely analogous here. Indeed, if we are doing open strings instead of closed strings, there would be a photon in the spectrum, and we would be doing literally this. Okay, so let's try to solve solve these equations in this space. The first constraint I want to impose, because it's very convenient, is the vanishing of L0 minus L0 bar. If you recall, the states are the same eigenvalue for L0 and L0 bar, but the holomorphic or anti-holomorphic oscillators raise either L0 or L0 bar. Essentially, L0 an is minus n an, which means they can immediately throw away everything which does not have the same amount of oscillators on the two sides. It's called Levin matching. So the next thing that survives, so this survives, and then the next things that survive are things like A minus 1 mu 1, A minus 1 mu 2, a minus 1 bar mu 3, a minus 1 bar mu 4, or things like a minus 2 mu 1, a minus 1 bar mu 2, a minus 1 bar mu 3, t, etc. Next, we can impose the constraint. Now, let's focus now on states of this form. So, L0 minus 1 acting on a state of this form tells you that B squared equals to 1. Sorry, there was a sign, wasn't there? That minus b squared over 2 minus 1. Yes. Okay. So that means that for this state, the momentum must be 2. The momentum squared must be 2. These states altogether can be thought of as the modes of a scalar field in space-time with negative mass squared. Right, so this, okay, so let's write down the spectrum. The first element in the spectrum is the tachyon. You can check that all of the other constraints are automatically satisfied because the LNs automatically kill the ground states. I mean, the oscillator ground states, because the LN always contains some positive. The positive LNs always contain some positive A, which annihilate the P's. And furthermore, this can never be in the image of some LNs because there is nothing else on top. So we are done with our constraints. These are definitely in the spectrum.
Sorry, mm-hmm. Where did the first constraint come from?
I just combined these two. So this is the first bad news. Bosonic string theory does not work. It has a tachyon. So that the theory is actually unstable, non-perturbatively. Nobody knows if there is some way to make it decay to something more stable or if it just doesn't make any sense. But anyway, let's keep going. Let's look at these states now. So for these states, the constraint now tells us that p squared vanishes. Because this is like p squared over 2 plus 1 on this minus 1. Sorry, it was a bar. Plus 1 minus 1. So if we can get any physical states, any string states from this mode, from these states in the Hilbert space, they will describe massless particles. Now, in order to impose that, to look at the other constraints, it's useful to introduce some polarization vector. So, the only constraint that really matters involves L1 or L1 bar. Because again, L2 is automatically going to kill the state. So what does L1 do when it acts on this state? Well, Well, it commutes across A1, A minus 1, and then annihilates this. And when it commutes across L1, so there is a commutator which gives A0 mu, which is the same as P mu. So as a result, this constraint tells you something like P mu epsilon mu nu A bar minus 1 nu P equal to 0. So let me write here the constraints. So I want this to vanish. Right? So the physical states will have to satisfy this constraint on the polarization that vanishes. On the other hand, if I compute L1, if I look for null states, I can look at L1 acting on A bar minus 1 mu p. This gives, lambda mu. This is just some other polarization vector. Then this gives me p mu lambda nu a mu minus 1 a bar mu minus 1 p. So null states are the ones for which the polarization is proportional to p mu.
Polarization is, I mean, this is just a tensor that you introduced, right? To have some
cool
definition in terms of, like, what's its relation to the states?
So a vector space, the elements of a vector space are linear combinations of basis elements. Do you agree with the statement? So I'm writing down a linear combination of my basis elements, a general linear combination. I mean, there is no reason to expect these equations to be solved by the basis elements. I need to impose the equations on linear combinations of the basis elements. Now, the whole space is graded by the eigenvalues of L1 and L minus 1. So when I take these linear combinations, I don't need to take infinite linear combination of every possible state. I can consistently take linear combinations of the states which live at some eigenvalue of L0 and L0 bar. Because the equations involve operators which just shift the eigenvalues by some amount. So if I'm trying to solve some linear equations in a vector space, and the vector space is a direct sum of pieces with different grading, and my linear equations preserve the grading, shifted by a constant amount, I can look for solutions in each degree separately. So the most general thing I can do is I can take linear combination of these ones and look for a solution. Okay.
I have a question a little
yes.
while back regarding the definition of your null states. Why are they the ones which are images which are in the image of Ln positive instead of negative?
Because when Ln positive.
Considering that condition on the top right of the.
Sorry. You're perfectly correct. I'm being silly. I meant negative. You're right. And indeed here, there's here's also supposed to be minus one. Otherwise, this equation would have made no sense. Thank you. OK, so the next level, I will not give a name yet to these states, but I think so the form epsilon mu nu a mu minus 1, a bar nu minus 1, p, such that p squared is 0, and p is orthogonal, the polarization is orthogonal to p, and the polarization is defined up to shifts of amounts proportional to p. So this comes from null states which are generated by L minus 1. These are null states that are generated by L minus 1 bar. In order to proceed, it's useful to.
But that state that you backed it up with by L minus 1, that's not a physical state.
No, that's right. Null states were just defined as something which is in the image of L minus 1 when acting on anything.
Okay, but there's no, but since this isn't in the physical state, like the set of physical states, why are we interested in it?
I'm interested when this is the set of the physical states. I don't care about this being in the set of physical states. This can be in the set of physical states, right? Because precisely because, well, when does this happen, right? Let me contract with this p. When are these null states physical? Well, p squared equal to 0, so this term drops out. And also, p has to be perpendicular to lambda. Lambda bar, sorry. So this definitely can happen. So it's useful to, so this polarization, I'm creating states which carry some Lorentz indices. It's useful to decompose them into representations of the Lorentz group. So in particular, I can decompose this polarization vector into a trace part. So I can take eta mu nu, a mu minus 1, a bar nu minus 1, e, an antisymmetric, a symmetric traceless part, and an antisymmetric part. So symmetric traces, I mean that epsilon mu nu equal epsilon nu mu, and also contacted with metric is 0. And antisymmetric, I just mean that it's antisymmetric in exchanging the indices. So given any tensor, I can always decompose it into these pieces. And I can ask, so once I do that, I need to be a little bit more careful if I want to. Okay, this, because I want this to be true, right? So I need something a little bit more careful here, something like epsilon mu nu, eta mu nu minus, what do I do? I forget. It takes a little bit more effort to separate out. Okay, I'm really saying poorly. For now, let me just split into symmetric and antisymmetric, and then we'll discuss further. How to split out the trace. It's a bit messy, actually. So if I look at the symmetric part now, what are the... So the fact that there are this sort of null polarizations that I'm subtracting off, from the point of view of space-time, is like saying that whatever field is described by these modes at low energy, it's going to have a gauge symmetry. Right? So this is analogous to the identification you put on the polarization of a field, which is a gauge field of some sort. So let's look how these gauge symmetries behave. So I guess something like that. Suppose I was trying to Fourier transform this, right, to sort of understand how the gauge symmetry might look like in space-time. So let's try to collect, you know, collect these polarizations into a field, and then see which sort of equations does this field satisfy. So I'll have some field H mu nu, which satisfies the wave equation, satisfies the constraint like that, and is defined up to shifts of this sort. I invite you to recognize this as the gauge symmetry of a linearized graviton. So if I study general relativity and I take the metric to be a small fluctuation of a flat metric, I write down Einstein equations and I impose appropriate transversality constraints, I end up with something like this. In particular, if I do a diffeomorphism, an infinitesimal diffeomorphism, the fluctuation of the metric will transform just like that. Now, if you do things carefully, actually, you will find that inside here there is both a fluctuation of a metric and a scalar field. So if you study infinitesimal perturbations of in general relativity, you get a field like this, which also satisfies some tracelessness constraint. So all in all, this gives us something like a spin shoe graviton. And a spin zero dilaton. Yeah, so you can disentangle them with a little bit more work, but the formulas are a bit messy. But yes, inside this symmetric tensor, you find both a graviton, an infinitesimal, a graviton, and a dilaton, a scalar field.
Just inside the symmetric part.
Now, I'm calling it graviton, but you can immediately ask, why do I call it graviton? Okay, it's something that satisfies the equations of motion of linearized gravity, but could I have other things that satisfy those equations? Does it have to behave like a graviton coupled to matter in to a stress tensor and things like that? Well, the answer actually is yes, in the sense that within quantum field theory, you can prove, within perturbative quantum field theory, you can prove that any massless spin shoe field with appropriate gauge symmetries has to behave like the graviton. The couplings to all the other fields are fixed by requiring that the scattering amplitudes behave well at very low momentum. There are some very beautiful theorems in quantum field theory. So as long as you behave that string theory, as long as you believe that string theory behaves like quantum field theory at low energy, it's pretty much automatic that at low energy, this mode will behave like the graviton perturbation theory. Now, if we study a field like that, well, that's a bit less familiar. called the Kaldramon field, I think. So it's a field which has two indices, antisymmetric, though, and which has a gauge symmetry. This is not this, okay. Now, if you have seen, how many of you have seen differential forms? A lot of you? Okay. So, differential forms are a convenient way to study things like, to study objects such as the connection of a gauge field connection. This field, which has two antisymmetric indices, can be thought of as a true form. Sort of a true form analog of a standard gauge field. This gauge transformation is shifts B by a total derivative. It's again the natural true form generalization of a standard gauge theory gauge transformation. So it turns out that while in four dimensions, abelian gauge fields only appear as one forms, in more than four dimensions, there is a whole tower of fields which behave almost like abelian gauge fields, which are abelian true-form fields or three-form fields or so on. So this is an example of an abelian true-form field. Now, abelian gauge fields, right, naturally coupled to particles. If you give me a one-form, you can naturally integrate it over a line. In the same way, if you give me a true form, you can naturally integrate it along, couple it to a surface. And these couplets are sort of topological, you don't need to have a metric to write them down. So in a sense, it's not that strange to find the true form field in a theory of strings. Right? If you were to ask yourself, what's the most natural field that I could have in a theory which could, in principle, have some very big string stretched across the universe, well, it would be a B field. And we'll see this, we'll see very soon that there's an example of a sort of a general principle that all sorts of things you can couple a string with appear as dynamical fields in string theory. So, but I will discuss this next week. For now, let's just say that we did this exercise, we found a spin two graviton, a spin zero dilaton, and a sort of spin one B field. And all these are massless fields. All of them satisfy p squared equal to zero. Then we had a tachyon, which was a scalar field. And then you get an infinite tower of other string states built from more complicated elements in the Fock space. Now, a state like this, for example, will have to have p squared equal to minus two. Just to discuss, impose a zero equal to one, and so on and so forth. So you get the tower of other states whose masses are two, four, masses squared, six, and so on and so forth, which have very complicated Lorentz indices. So high, they're sort of high spin, higher spin. But they're higher spin massive particles. So that's not a not a terribly interesting statement.
I have a question about the B field.
Yes.
When you say we should think of it as a spin one particle, there's an analogy here that kind of like the B field, which has two indices, like the field strength of the gauge field.
No, it's just a name. It's a silly name in the sense that the notion of spin one, spin zero, spin two, and so on really makes sense in four dimensions. If you are in higher than two dimensions, you should label particles by representations of the little group, which in this case is SO 24. But in many ways, this behaves analog of spin one fields in four dimensions. That's all I meant here. That's why I put it in inverted commas. If you write, they're sort of the natural gauge field sourced by a string. When we study superstrings, we'll find a more interesting spectrum, which you actually have even higher form fields, so fields with antisymmetric indices. With many antisymmetric indices. And there will be fields that couple to deep brains of various dimensions. Anyway, let's see. What can I say? Right, so now massless higher spin theories would have been problematic. Again, there are theories in quantum field theory that tell you that if a particle is massless and has spin higher than two, it's free and it cannot interact with other particles. But massive higher spin theories are not a problem. Can you tell me a theory where at low energy you find massive higher spin theories, higher spin particles? It's almost every day.
QCD.
That's right. So if you look at the spectrum of hadrons, you find hadrons of very high spin and massive. It's a pretty common thing to have, in some low-energy effective field theory, a spectrum of massive particles of increasing mass and spin. Indeed. So one of the reasons people started studying string theory at the beginning is because they wanted to use it as a model for hadrons. Then they found a massless particle and said, no, this is garbage. And then they saw it was massless graviton and they got interested again. But not for QCD, clearly. Now, holography offers a way in which string theory can be connected to QCD in principle still. But it's not string theory in flat space-time. If you take a large N QCD, it's likely to have a string theory dual of some sort. Nobody knows how to write it down, and it involves strings moving in some very strongly curved space-time. Five-dimensional space-time. Okay, so I think this is all I wanted to say about the string spectrum. Do you have any questions? So from now on, I want to start discussing matters of ghosts and BRST quantization so that we can...
So after we model null states, this is
pre-reducible
representation.
Sorry, is it?
After we model null states, this is pre-reducible.
Right, there is a big tower of irreducible representations. You can try to count how many you get for every representations of the little group. Notice that. For massive particles, you have, there are still some null states to be subtracted off, but the combinatorics become increasingly complicated. If you want to, it's a fun exercise to check what was the spectrum for the level two. Now, which sort of higher spin particles do you find at m squared equal to two? If you do the exercise, you find that there are some interesting facts that only happen because you're because D is 26. Okay. Now, I was wondering what is the proper way to start introducing ghosts in GST quantization. I personally feel that it's useful to just be aware of a more general notion, which is that of cohomological quantum field theory. So there's sort of a general machinery that we can use to describe quantum field theories, where you introduce some extra degrees of freedom just as a computational tool, which you really don't want to get rid of at the end of the calculation. So and cohomological quantum field theory gives you a general strategy to do that. So let me see if I have a white, a clean board somewhere. Okay. So cohomological quantum field theory is a quantum field theory with an odd symmetry generator, a Grassmann odd. Such that which squares to zero. The Grassmann odd symmetry generator is a symmetry which relates bosons and fermions. We want it to square to zero, and then you take the space of observables of your theory. You restrict yourself to observables that are Q-closed. Meaning observables that are annihilated by this symmetry. And then you quotient. Now inside the Q-closed observables, there are Q-exact observables. Which means observables that are of the form Q of something else. So the idea is that you're looking for the space of Q closed observables modulo Q exact observables. The exact ones live inside the closed ones because Q squared is zero. And say that these are the sort of the physical observables. Yes?
You said that Q generates both bosons and fermions?
Q. Because it's Grassmann odd, when Q acts on the bosonic observables, it gives you a fermionic observable. When it acts on a fermionic observable, it gives you a bosonic one.
So Q acts on the space of observables.
That's right. It's a symmetry of the theory. So it acts on the space of observables, and it preserves correlation functions. Right? Which means that if I have something like correlation function of Q or 1, or 2 or 3 plus now minus plus O1 Q or 2 or 3 plus O1 or 2 Q or 3. Okay. Vanish. Right. So what does the symmetry mean? The symmetry is something that has world identities. If you take a correlation function and you add individual on each observable, and you add them up, you're supposed to get zero. Here I put some signs because some of these observables might be Fermi, Grassmann odd, and Q is Grassmann odd. So when I carry Q across the observable, for example, when I carry Q across U or one to Acton or Chu, I might need to put a minus sign, and so on.
So Q acts on that whole correlation function, and then you pull it through to act on each.
That's right, and that should be zero because it's a symmetry.
Kind of like a Leibniz rule.
Yes, if you want. Well, it's you can think about this as both Leibniz rule together with a Stokes theorem, meaning the correlation function is like an integral. I want the integral of a total derivative to be zero. And this analogy is actually quite precise. But also, right, take a correlation function of a quantum field theory and check that it's translation invariant. Well, you add the derivative of the first operator plus derivative of the second operator, plus derivative of the third operator, and you get zero, right? Because you've shifted the whole thing, and the answer should not change. The reason we're quotient by something exact is that if this operator was, so this is an exact operator, right? If I put an exact operator inside correlation functions of closed operators, I get zero. Because this vanishes and this vanishes. That's the reason it makes sense to look at correlation functions of Q closed operators modulo Q exact operators. I get sort of a smaller set of correlation functions which defines a simpler theory. And that might be the theory I'm looking for. But it's possible that that theory was very hard to describe in terms of irreducible degrees of freedom. And it was more convenient to use a bigger set of degrees of freedom and then cut down this way. Another useful feature of this setup is that if I take my action and I shift it by something which is Q exact, again, so the correlation functions will not change. So when I define this setup, I can sort of deform the ambient theory in very controlled ways without changing the properties of the physical theory nested inside. So in the context of gauge theory, we're trying to describe a physical photon, say. Physical photon is hard to describe in quantum field theory by itself because it has only two polarizations. But there is no, we're trying to describe a representation of the little group. But when I write a field theory, I typically need to use representation of the Lorentz group. And all representation of the Lorentz group I can write contains the physical photon plus other stuff. And to get rid of the other stuff, I need to introduce a gauge symmetry and pick some gauge fixing operations to do calculations. And then I need to worry, oh, are these gauge fixing choices equivalent? Do they still remain equivalent when I quantize? Does quantization preserve gauge symmetry? All these questions can be very hard. In the Beeristic quantization, you sort of prepare an ambient theory which has some extra ghosts, but has this odd symmetry, inside of which you can embed your physical polarization of the photon. They try to have a setup where this quotient only contains the physical polarization of the photon. Then all the details like gauge fixing and so on, they're all encoded in the Lagrangian of this ambient theory. And different choices of gauge fixing and other choices like that are just modifications of the ambient Lagrangian by Q exact things, which are pretty much guaranteed not to change the answer as long as the symmetry remains, that this symmetry remains a symmetry. So it's a very convenient formalism. Now, I would like to start illustrating it in situations which are not even a quantum field theory. I mean, the simplest example of this cohomological quantum field theories can be found in zero dimensions. What is a zero-dimensional quantum field theory? It's just an integral, a standard integral. So a lot of you have done differential forms, so I feel that perhaps using those as an example might be reasonable. So, right, a differential form is an expression like this, some function of on a manifold which has a bunch of indices which are anti-symmetric under permutation. And it's convenient to sort of contract these indices with some symbols which are anti-symmetric. So there are nice operations on forms. There is a wedge product where you sort of multiply these two expressions and you anti-symmetrize the indices. There is an exterior derivative. Which raises the degree of the form by one. Let's just take a derivative of your form. And you anti-symmetrize. It just so happened that this square vanishes. And this satisfies Leibniz's rule. Now, a nice feature of forms is that forms can be integrated on manifolds or submanifolds without having to specify a metric. They sort of come equipped with their own measure. Or if you want, when I change coordinates, I get this. Right, I should say that this is the definition of the form in the patch of the manifold. When I change patch, I just change the coordinates inside here and contract those indices with a bunch of Jacobians. Intuitively, the reason you write dx is because the Jacobian is dx over dx prime. So you just formally rewrite dx mu as this. And you get the transformation of your form. So forms can be defined globally on the manifold in a nice way, and they can be integrated on manifolds or some manifolds because they come with their own power, already with the powers of the Jacobian that you need to make sense of changes of coordinates. So it makes sense to write things like the integral of my manifold, say the manifold has dimension d, or some form of degree d. This is just the integral of omega 1 to d, dx1, dxd. It makes sense to do something integral of omega d prime, wedge omega prime, d minus d prime. So I can wedge two forms and then integrate them. And if you give me a submanifold, it even makes sense to integrate these forms on the submanifold. If you want to write an expression, you can write something like this, sort of the obvious. Where these y's are local coordinates on your manifold, and then dy1, dyn. Okay. So, a nice property of form, an important way to use forms, among other things, is that you can ask about closed forms and integrals of closed forms. And you find things like the integral of a product of closed forms does not change if I shift one of the closed forms by an exact form because of that. So you can sort of study correlation functions of closed forms modulo exact forms. And although the space of forms itself is very big, right? Infinite dimensional, I have functions, right? It's a space of functions. It turns out that the space of closed forms modulo exact forms, which is called the cohomology, it's finite dimensional. It encodes interesting topological properties of your manifold. So in a sense, when you start looking at closed form modulo exact forms, you, although you're working in this enormous ambient space of functions, effectively you are asking some very topological questions, finite dimensional questions about your manifold. For example, I invite you to look at the space of closed form modulo exact forms for a circle. So if you have a circle, your forms are just the one, look at the one forms. The one forms are just one function times the theta, where theta is the angle. Asking for, and it's always closed because there are no true forms. So the day of the one form would be a true form, but there are no true forms on the circle. Now, when is such a form exact? It's exact when I can write it as derivative of another function with respect of theta, the theta. Now, not all functions on the circles are derivative of another function. One is not a derivative of something. It's a derivative of theta, but theta is not a function because it's not periodic. So the one closed form modulo exact form detect the fact that the circle is not a line, that there is a periodicity, there are loops. So the cohomology captures topological fact about your manifold. Now, it's very easy to write these expressions as a cohomological quantum field theory. What do? I just look at I just add some extra variables, odd variables. So I take my original variables and then add some other variables, and we call them C mu. Secretly, these C mu's are just literally the dx mu's. I'm just gonna give them a different name. Okay. And I say Q, which is secretly D, right? Q of X will map X into C. And Q of C will be zero. Okay. Now, suppose there's some, so your general, what is a function on this space? Right? A function on this space is something like F of X, mu 1 to mu n. C mu 1, C mu 2, C mu n. When I've got some variables, functions are just polynomials. And because the C's are Grassmann variables, this is antisymmetric. And so this is antisymmetric too. So let's try to integrate something like F mu 1, mu d, C mu 1, C mu d on this Grassmann on this manifold, right? Turns out I don't need a measure because I have dx1 to dxd, and then I have dc1 to dcd. Using this definition, it's very natural to say that when x is a function of some other variables, then the news, you write just the C, says C prime dx over dx prime. You just define your C as Q of this. So see, this definition is compatible with saying the Q of X prime is C prime, and Q of C prime is zero. This is not a trivial fact. See, when acton X, right, Q is the act as a derivation, right? So it takes the derivative of X with respect to X prime and then transforms X prime. And then I need to also check that QC is zero. So Q kills C prime, but it acts non-trivial on this. So Q of C becomes something like a second derivative of X contracted with two C's. Because the C's are Grassmann odd, this anti-symmetrizes the derivative and kills it. So this symmetry is compatible with transformations of coordinates. So I can really define this setup on a manifold, not just on a patch. And then the measure is automatically good because this transforms by the Jacobian, this transforms by the inverse Jacobian. This is a standard transformation rule of Grassmann variables. And also, you know that Grassmann integrals work like integral of C to C is 1, integral of the C is 0. So when I do this integral, each the C kills one of the C's. And I'm left with just the integral of the form F. So the correlation function of F in this quantum field theory is the same as the integral of F as a form. And the product of observables is the same as the wedge product of forms. Q of an observable is the same as the differential of that form. And so studying Q closed modulo Q exact observables here, it's studying the topology of your manifold. So an intuitive way to think about this is that fermionic variables cancel bosonic variables. Here I have as many fermionic variables related by symmetry in a very straightforward way. So locally in each patch of my manifold, the bosons and the fermions are canceling completely. All that is left is some global information about how these patches are attached to each other. So all that is left is the topology of the manifold. So in gauge theory, we'll have a sort of intermediate situation where, sorry, I'm going badly over time. I don't know what happened. I have some space of fields with some gauge orbits. What I'm really interested in is sort of counting each gauge orbit as one point. So we're going to introduce ghosts that go along the orbit, such that at least locally they cancel out the bosonic directions along the orbit, leaving behind just information about the space of orbit itself. Okay.